solution, working backwards on a tiny mind. I get more primitive each day, fitting it to the decline. I'm getting pretty headstrong, shrugging all of care. Surely if you think I'm gonna tell what it's like, then guess you don't know. I've been waiting, and I take it from the inside, and I put it on the outside. Well, I got no more to give. Already had too much tonight.
Brother, sell me be meaner. Go gal, go Papalina, Papalina. Yeah, she my gal. Oh, Papalina, Papalina. Yeah, she my gal. She's my gal and I love her so. Scooby doo be meaner. Go gal, go. With all the school bell ringer, everybody go out. Going to the shack, we're gonna shake it all about. Papalina looking like the moon on the wire. Man, I dig that crazy now. Nah, when she gets going, she's a real cool chick. Go stick. Papalina, Papalina. Yeah, she my gal. Oh, Papalina, Papalina. Yeah, she my gal. Oh, oh, oh. I'm my gal and I love her so. Scooby doo, Melina, go gal, go.
Thus form candles or candelabra beside them, of the same size, and so the whole would be composed of 7 or even 9 canvases. Now, although we do not have any paintings of sunflowers here, adjacent to La Berceuse, we have hung a bouquet of flowers, painted around the same time in Saint-Rémy, after Van Gogh's nervous breakdown. In this vase of roses, the entire cycle of life is played out by the flowers as they bud, bloom, and drop their petals. Originally, the flowers were probably pale pink. The pigment has faded over the years. The foreground shelf on which the vase sits was definitely a bright pink. You can see its original color at the very bottom edge of the painting, near the frame. We, too, have a great canvas of irises, in which the off-white background was originally painted a brilliant but fugitive pink. It will be wonderful to be able to see these two together in adjoining galleries. On either side of the exit doorway from this gallery are 2 great Gauguins. At the right is the majestic portrait of 2 women. Do spend some time before this imposing and evocative portrait, perhaps of a mother and daughter, a work of considerable emotive power and presence. Then, to the left of the doorway is our next stop, the Siesta. You should now be at the Siesta. The Metropolitan's Ia Orana Maria, which I invite you to look at later, is the major religious icon of Gauguin's first Tahitian period. This painting, on the other hand, stands as a secular masterpiece of the same period. Gauguin had gone to Tahiti in hopes of a purer existence, and a cheaper one, among the beautiful natives whom he felt were free of the taint of Western society. That was not entirely true, evidently, as we can see from the clothing of these women. Their dress imposed by Christian missionaries. Even the fabric was imported from Europe. The dramatic, rushing perspective of the pink and lavender floorboards sets out the space of a deep porch on which Gauguin depicts women relaxing, at harmony with their surroundings, and at ease in their everyday world. They are quietly self-absorbed, disposing themselves with the natural grace that attracted Gauguin from the very beginning. In the background, a figure sits with his or her back to the scene, perhaps next to a fire which provides coals to heat up the iron. The composition was arrived at after careful consideration, and on close inspection, numerous changes can be observed. The sarong of the woman in the foreground, for example, was originally deep red, not midnight blue, and the basket was initially a dog. Each figure was carefully outlined on the canvas before being painted in, and traces of one who had once lain by the first post on the left are still faintly visible. The landscape, painted in the hot colors of the South Seas, blocks in the porch, seeming to rise vertically, especially the dark green mass at the back that lifts away from the spatial perspective of the planks. This, one of Gauguin's most ambitious pictures, was clearly one that absorbed him completely, one in which he seems to have worked for a considerable time. The result of his efforts is a work in which a scene of domestic tranquility and natural grace assumes almost iconic status through grandeur of conception. Before we continue our tour, I encourage you to step back and compare the still lives on either side of the door through which you entered this gallery. The Cézanne at the left, that we saw together briefly earlier, and at the right, what may well be Gauguin's most Cézannesque still life. Indeed, Gauguin owned and treasured a Cézanne still life not unlike the one in this collection. Then, whenever you're ready, our tour continues in the final gallery. In this last gallery, we find works that date from the turn of the 19th century well into the 20th. Let's begin immediately to your left as you enter, with a work hanging by itself on the short wall. It's The Studio by Georges Braque, and it is one of Walter Annenberg's most recent acquisitions. It is also the latest work in his collection, dating from 1939. This picture, which sums up Braque's major artistic concerns, introduces a series of large paintings the artist would make over a 17-year period, exploring the spaces he worked in for most of his life. In it, he depicts his studio, much as Matisse had done in his celebrated canvases of the first years of this century. At the right, there's an easel with a pink star which would turn into a soaring bird in later compositions. In front of it, a stool that reminds us of Van Gogh's own cane chair. Next, on a table, a palette and brushes, emblematic of his profession. And next to a window, a vase with leaves in it, set up as a still life. The composition is arranged as a late cubist depiction of space with a play of interconnecting planes which weave foreground and background together. It's also filled with fascinating textures. Look closely, and you'll see that Braque has mixed gritty sand with his paint. And in places such as the table on which the palette rests, he has enlivened the surface by scratching rippled, wavy lines into it. This is a painting about texture, spatial relationships, and subtle and unexpected color harmonies. Walter Annenberg had known and coveted this picture for a long time, but it had eluded him until it turned up on the New York market last year. At first, it seems an abrupt departure from the rest of the collection, but the collector himself points out that although this picture was done in a formal, abstracted mode, all the elements within it are easily recognizable. Pure abstraction has not been to Walter Annenberg's taste, but what has been is the joie de vivre that comes unmistakably through this rich, harmonious painting. Walter Annenberg likes pictures that tell stories, pictures that are alive and deal with nature. There's a compelling life force evident throughout this collection. Our last stop is directly opposite the door through which you entered this gallery. It's another recent acquisition. Picasso's Au Lapin Agile, an icon of Bohemian Paris, depicts a celebrated cabaret. Mr. Annenberg translates it as the sprightly rabbit. Picasso said that all of his work was biography. And here, true to form, he depicts himself, dressed as his alter ego, a harlequin. One of the most aggressive clowns in the Commedia dell'arte repertoire, always whacking people with a bat. His pose is self-conscious and highly expressive, finished off perfectly by his elongated, almost Van Dyckian hands. Next to him sits a pale, aloof woman with extraordinary, salacious scarlet lips, which speak volumes about her life and personality. Her name is Germaine Pichot. The two are blatantly ignoring each other, and in the background, depicted in quick shorthand strokes, is Freddy, the owner of this particular Montmartre dive, wearing wooden clogs and playing a guitar. Picasso shows himself reflectively. It is hard on Germaine, giving her not only the lips, but the costume of a whore. Picasso had affairs with many women, but this one was special. When he first moved to Paris, she was involved with his close friend Carlos Casagemas. Spurned by Germaine, Casagemas attempted to shoot her, only grazing her in the process. Then he turned the gun on himself. Casagemas' suicide was a key event in Picasso's early emotional life. Among his most moving early works were depictions of what he imagined his friend looked like in his coffin, with a bullet in his head. Nonetheless, Picasso would continue to see this woman all the way into the 40s, and she would marry more than one of his friends. Picasso seems as much taken by this story and the tension that both unites and separates these figures as he is by the wiry yet supple line with which he renders them, and the colors, bright yet mysterious against the overall brownish background of the interior. This is a picture about alienation, about absinthe, unrequited and unconsummated love. Much later in life, after World War II, Picasso would take his young lover, Françoise Gillot, mother of Paloma Picasso, to see an old lady, toothless and sick, lying in bed. As Françoise herself related, "I stood by the door, and Pablo talked quietly with her. After a few minutes, he laid some money on the table. She thanked him profusely, and we went out again. Picasso said, 'I want you to learn about life. That woman is old and toothless and poor and unfortunate now. But when she was young, she was very pretty, and she made a painter friend of mine suffer so much that he committed suicide. She turned a lot of heads. Now look at her.'" This compelling Picasso is Walter Annenberg's most recent acquisition. It is no doubt possible, should I say probable, that Mr. Annenberg, whose eyes are as sharp as ever, and whose thirst for collecting may not yet have been slaked by putting its collection on tour or announcing its bequest to the Metropolitan, may yet have a few surprises for us when the collection returns to this museum in 1993. Then it will be on view in our newly renovated 19th century European galleries. We're looking forward to seeing you there. Our tour, however, is over. In the next room, you'll be able to purchase posters, postcards, as well as the extensively annotated catalog. There, you should also return your acoustic guide. Then, I hope you'll step out into our current 19th century galleries and spend some time with the Metropolitan's pictures, those I've been talking about. Goodbye, and thank you for joining me. This exhibition is made possible by the May Department Stores Company.